Imagine the competitive advantage. You're one authorized as a CASP, and two, you're legally allowed to passport in every other jurisdiction.
There is the hope that on day one of MiCA, there might actually be operators that will manage to get a CASP license.
Yeah, this is my objective, and yes.
Hi everyone, today we have another episode of Block 101. Today with us we have the deputy head of FinTech Supervision within the MFSA, the Malta Financial Services Authority, Kamil Pepos. Kamil, thanks for coming.
Good morning.
Before we start discussing MiCA and more widely FinTech in Malta and the EU, tell us something fun about yourself. Tell us something about your hobbies, how you spend your little free time that you have.
Yes, first of all, thanks for the invite. Let me start with that. So what do I do when I'm not working on MiCA? I picked up boating as a hobby, so that's
you chose the right country.
Exactly. I thought I'm on an island, why not? So I'm doing that on the weekend, especially finding places where there's no network, so no one can contact me, especially my boss. But yes, generally that's what I try to do on the weekend, like everyone else, you know, just relax, not thinking about work. So if you see me at sea, say hi, but please don't speak to me about work.
Yeah. I'll try. So, Kamil, the fintech team at the MFSA is recognized as by industry practitioners as a breath of fresh air, in that you are very approachable, very helpful, but at the same time you maintain a certain level of professionalism and seriousness that basically helps the industry a lot, especially such a new industry like the fintech industry. This attitude has been very important for the industry to develop. You are coming from the private sector, so you have come from the other side, let's call it that way, and usually it's the other way around. People move from the regulator to the private sector, but you have done the inverse movement. Now that you are on the other side, what are the things you would like to tell practitioners in order to make their lives easier, but also the MFSA's life easier when dealing with the authority?
All right, so the first thing is you have someone that understands you. I think that this is why I made the move, or I was invited to make the move, to have someone that speaks the same language. And I think it shows, and I enjoy the relationship that I have with everyone. I think ultimately everyone understands the role of the regulator. Everyone has different objective. Obviously, as a business, you want to grow, you want to make profits, etc. And as the regulator, you're more thinking of how do I protect consumers. So those objectives are quite noble. I think everyone can appreciate those. So how I would approach if I was a practitioner or even an industry participant is, let's have an open dialogue with the regulator. Ultimately, as a regulator, I will learn about it. I mean, whatever you're trying to hide, at some point I will learn about it. So I always prefer and value someone that is transparent from the get-go, speaks, is open, because this is how you build a relationship. If I cannot trust you, I'm going to keep digging. This is as simple as that. I mean, anyone that has raised child will say this is, you know, how a child becomes independent, because there's someone that can be trusted in the long term. So then that someone is autonomous. So when I have industry participants that I know at every opportunity have been transparent with me, spoke, approach me directly before me learning from the market that something was wrong or an event, say, oh, okay, this is someone I can trust. If I can put my trust in you, then we build a great relationship. So I think that's one, the transparency. The second, I think, and this is something that really I had to change a bit my mindset coming from the private sector to the public sector, you have to realize that you will work with the regulator for the foreseeable future. So if you're in the private sector and you don't like a supplier, brush it off, you'll find another one. You cannot find another regulator. So and thinking that generally people at the regulator will spend, if not a career, but a good 5, 10 years, you're bound to speak with the same people. And here, this is where, I mean, in personal life or professional life, you need to think of, what do I value most? Winning a small argument or building a relationship? And I think that some small battles, some small, you know, battle of the ego sometime, you know, just let it go. This is what's most important. And sometimes I see that wall, you know, being built. And again, you know, I'm not a lawyer. You're one, but you know, sometimes those legal arguments with the regulator and there back and forth. Just let it go, guys.
I agree. I've been a regulator myself, and I always say that if the regulator wants to suspend your license, they will always find a way how to do it. Like so, but also it is also true, to be fair, that as lawyers, there are particular lawyers have a much more difficult position than other practitioners, for the simple reason that they are bound by their code of conduct to basically do everything possible in the interest of their client. So even in terms of transparency, it's not always possible to be totally correct. Transparent. But then there's an attitude and an attitude. And I believe that changes everything.
No, absolutely. I think this is the most important, you know, transparency, conflict resolution, really. And something that I've told my team on day one, I say, if you have a problem, just pick up the phone.
Exactly.
Stop with those emails. I mean, I cannot deal with that anymore. Those little, you know, fight by email.
Doing and throwing on little
things.
You
know, like the keyboard warrior. You know, like everyone is can send a strong-worded letter. But just pick up the phone and say, hey, guys, come to the authority. You know, our coffee is good. I'll offer you one. And just trash this out. And I think this is where we can make a lot of progress. Yeah, and this is the attitude we took with VFA. I mean, yes, you know, we're processing application. I don't get to the point where I want to go, or I'm not making enough progress. You know, like I've done multiple times with you or the practitioner. Hey, Joe, just let's have a call because there's something I'm not understanding. I cannot get to the bottom of it. And I think those simple trick, you know, or way of doing
they
things
go a long way.
Very long way. Very, very long way. Yes.
Amazing. So we touched upon crypto now. So Malta got it right when everyone got it wrong. That is the statement I like to say. In the eyes of many, Blockchain Island has failed miserably. It did not. And the reality is that there are quite a few really big operators that got a license in Malta. They did not get affected by crypto winters or moments where the industry was in a very, very bad place, like when FTX went bust. But also, it is also true that it has not lived to its expectation, and maybe it's because the expectations were raised too high at the time, but also because it was early. So the Maltese framework was the only, and still is probably the only comprehensive framework that is out there in terms of crypto in Europe, at least. But now we've seen that MiCA, the European regulation, is, I wouldn't say a carbon copy, but is almost identical to our laws. And yes, we got it right there, and kudos to the people that worked on that from the MFSA side. I know that some of them are no longer there, some of them are still in the fintech team, but they had foresight. And I believe that foresight in today's world is one of the most important things, much more important than being very clever or very knowledgeable about something. So seeing this development and evolution of the regulatory framework in Europe, why is Malta still the best jurisdiction for our crypto asset service providers, more than maybe issuers, to obtain their MiCA license?
All right. Simple answer, because we got it right. No, I think, and if you allow me, I'll touch upon a bit, the blockchain island and whatever. I think what's important is how you define success. So yes, the expectations were really high. I mean, there's this saying, shoot for the star and you land on the moon. And I think this is what happened there. If for us success was having five companies, yes, of course, we overachieve. I think the number was much higher, but at the MFSA from the beginning, and we made it very, very clear with practitioner, with the industry, for us being so successful would be having a few high quality player and build something sustainable. Why? Because we need to be conscious of our size, would it be the ecosystem of the or the regulator. If we would have grown, have 300 or 1,000 ecosystem player, it's impossible for me to do a job satisfactory so I can sleep at night. This is as simple as that. And I think that the jurisdiction deserves it. I mean, how many mistakes can we afford? I mean, when you're a small jurisdiction, I mean, you're trying to diversify your economy and whatever, you have to get it right. You cannot get it wrong. So I think this was really the key here. And if we define, the metric for success of developing something that is sustainable, that has survived through the crypto winter and whatever, I think we've been extremely successful. So I think that's the first point. What advantage? What do we have over other jurisdiction or whatever? And I'm a bit biased, obviously, but an experienced crypto regulator. I don't think that there's a lot of financial regulator in the world that can say that they have 5 years experience authorizing and supervising this industry. And obviously, today we're not at the same place that we were 5 years ago. Definitely. I mean, everyone has grew, everyone learn. We know today much more than we know 5 years ago, for sure. And we should not underestimate this learning curve. This is really important, especially for regulator that generally are not really good with technology. Let's face it. So that's one. Obviously, regulator is only one part of the ecosystem. What we have here is over the last 5 years, we've built a really robust ecosystem in a sense that we have some market leaders. We do as VASP. I mean, we have some of the really big names here. We have law firms. We have auditors. So we have people that know what to do with the crypto industry. Other regulator know also. I mean, the FIU, the tax authority, MBR, because we're just at the very beginning, right? I mean, I can grant you a license, but if the rest of the jurisdiction does not understand the thing about crypto and hate crypto, you're not gonna go very far as a business, right? So I think we have that ecosystem. We have, even in terms of talent, we have compliance professionals. And thanks to other industry like gaming, we also have talent when it comes to development or IT, because let's face it, those are a technology company. I mean, if I come to a jurisdiction that there's no developer, there's no one that can take care of my IT, I'm not gonna go very far. So I think we managed to create something that works. Obviously, it's a small jurisdiction. You're not gonna have as much talent or as many talent as other bigger jurisdiction, but we have, for the size of the jurisdiction,
So
we
easy
have.
to import into Malta talent because especially younger people, at least I've seen this in other industries. You mentioned gambling. We it was much easier to import younger people to
Of course.
Malta than it will be easy to import, without mentioning other cities that might be want to compete with Malta in the future, in a gray city where you have quite a few also social problems and so on. So I think that also helps. But I would like to touch a bit more on this point. The fact that we have an ecosystem, and the ecosystem goes two ways. It's the commercial and the operational ecosystem where you have a number of operators. And you have the regulatory and services ecosystem. And I agree with you that the fact that there are law firms that are knowledgeable about the technology, you have audit firms, you have the regulators, the various regulators. We have the MDIA, we have the MFSA, we have the tax authorities, we have even the IDPC, the commissioner for privacy. We have a lot of authorities that are knowledgeable and a lot of service providers. But from an operational perspective, I believe that an ecosystem also needs various kinds of operators. So, and maybe that's where Blockchain Island didn't succeed, in the sense that, yes, I agree with you that you have to have a few good ones, but if you only had the big ones, then it's not a complete ecosystem. We've seen it in gambling, for example, where many operators, larger operators, buy smaller operators and they grow by actually acquiring smaller operators that would have got something right in a particular niche, in a particular product. I'm not seeing this as much in the VFA section. I'm seeing still that we have probably a good 10 big companies. The rest are smallish, but ultimately there isn't enough room to maneuver for the bigger companies to acquire the smaller ones that are doing something so different. So
no, you're completely right on that, and super pleased you brought up that point. Yes, an ecosystem needs to be giant, made of giants and small guys, because for innovation, essentially you have two ways of, you know, either you pour money into R&D as a big one and don't know where it goes, or otherwise you take a shortcut and buy the innovative guy, right? I mean, essentially corporate innovation, those are the two routes, either by investment in a company or R&D. So we need that. We need the small guy challenging the big guy. The small guy developing a niche product. Why this didn't happen potentially is because we need to reflect a bit on our framework and say maybe our framework is not super startup friendly. And I think this is the important, and we can touch upon a bit on the framework as well, because I think is important. But because we were so early, we had to have very high barrier to entry, because we could not afford to let every mom and pop shop come and do something in crypto, because we know that, you know, you need to be a serious operator. You need to have certain controls in place for us to feel confident and not raise the risk of the jurisdiction. So now that we have direction with Mika, and on certain point Mika is much more startup friendly, I think it's going to get much better. On that, if you allow me, because I think this is also one key advantages that we have, I'll touch upon a bit on the framework, the transition, sure, as well from VFA to Mika. So obviously VFA is very, very close to Mika. In our opinion, we're actually the closest framework. I've not seen a framework closer to Mika than us. And that means multiple things. One, that means that any existing license holder will transition very smoothly to Mika, because they're already at that level of requirement. They've already made the investment. You know, they have the compliance right, they have the internal control right, you know, the three-line model, all of those investments, because obviously roughly everyone does AML, you know, across Europe and across the world. But getting into the prudential and conduct requirements requires another level of maturity, you know, a certain level of investment. So that has been done. So our existing license holder will have it easy. Let's put it this way. But where it becomes super interesting is that within Mika, there is the what's called the simplified authorization process. And I don't want to get into the specific legally and whatever, but essentially what the audience needs to remember, what it means is that if you are subject and licensed under a Mika equivalent framework, you will not need to be reauthorized to become a CASP. What will need to happen is that the regulator needs to look at the gap and say, you know, already have all those elements, Mika requires me, all of that, plus those two documents. I'll just ask those two documents. So I just bridge the gap and automatically you become a CASP.
Will you be doing this before MiCA becomes applicable?
So before MiCA is applicable, so in the 18 months, I cannot officially issue any CASP license. But of course, that gap analysis happens then.
Exactly.
So this is important. So this is important for the existing one, but this is also important for any prospective applicants. I'm seeing right now a lot of international group or group that are based in other jurisdiction that are kind of, you know, window shopping. Let's put it this way, you know, saying, hey, listen, I will need the MiCA license because how can I say no to Europe? I want to be in Europe when MiCA is applicable. Where should I base myself? Since this is a regulation and the rules are going to be the same. So today, we've seen already international group making the step of saying, to be prepared and to be really in the starting block and one of the first CASP, why don't I come to Malta? I explore. I look what it takes to become a VFA service provider. I get license before the provision for CASP are applicable, and then I benefit from this simplified.
So there is the hope that on day one of MiCA, there might actually be operators that will manage to get a CASP license.
Yeah, this is my objective,
and
yes.
The advantage, and the advantage is, obviously, passporting. So
exactly.
On day one, they can actually passport their services all over the EU.
Correct. So the ideal scenario for someone that's is really prepared, has worked well with us, as everything is the day where the CASP provision are applicable. I exchange, you give me the VFA license, I give you a MiCA license. From there, I will do the notification to all the other NCAs and you can passport. So just imagine the competitive advantage.
Of course.
Someone within the first few weeks, let's maybe not commit on day one, but the first few weeks of the CASP provision being applicable, you're one, authorized as a CASP, and two, you're legally allowed to passport in every other jurisdiction. While a competitor that maybe is based in another jurisdiction will have only started the authorization process, because legally, you cannot receive a CASP application before the provision are applicable. Even if I receive it, I cannot touch it. So just imagine. I mean, we know how long it takes for someone to be licensed. 12 months, something like that. And I mean, do you want to bet or do you want to take a chance and say, let me wait the last minute for me to submit an application to a regulator that might not know anything about crypto.
And there's a learning curve for these regulators.
One, there's a learning curve and also the bottleneck. I mean, we've seen in other jurisdictions, like in the UK, where, I mean, the regulator was overflown by the number of applications. I mean, there's a limit. How much can I process, you know? And we're seeing right now, there's an estimation of roughly 1,000 to 1,500 VASP across Europe that will need to become CASP. So take that by the number of member states. Obviously, it might not be equal, but you could expect between 50 to 100 bigger jurisdiction, maybe 200 application on day one. Imagine. I mean, as a regulator, if I receive 200 application on day one, I have to prioritize. How do I prioritize? I look at the application. Oh, I'm missing a document. Bottom of the pile. Oh, I have a question. Bottom of the pile. You know, I will have to prioritize and say, let me take the best of the best. The guys that are, you know, the application is complete. All the questions are there. So you might find yourself bit in a limbo where the application is not processed as fast as you would want. And then by the end of the 18 months after the CASP provision are applicable, if you are not licensed, you need to stop.
Exactly.
So, I mean, you're putting your business in jeopardy, essentially. So, I mean, quite a detailed explanation here. But to me, yes, if I was still on the other side of the table, I'll say, it really doesn't cost me anything or very little to explore what's happening in Malta. I mean, we're very approachable. I've always welcome having, you know, courtesy meeting. I have no problem. And international groups, I'm looking around. You know, what do you have to offer? What's your approach? You know, and I'll mention those exact same facts. So, and again, we have qualified law firms here. You know, someone like you, for example. So yes, when as an international group, those are things that should be considered. How prepared I am to Mika, and do I want to wait the last minute, and do I want to risk being caught in bottlenecks?
And bottlenecks because of the amount of applications exactly. that will come in the last few months.
Exactly. So what steps can I do today?
Start now.
Start now. Simple as that.
So the MFSA is again taking the lead in the crypto industry by issuing a guideline on NFTs. You have very recently issued a guideline on how NFTs should be treated. Can you tell us something briefly about it?
Yes, yes, of course. So what were the objective of that guideline? I mean, obviously NFT is a hype. That's fine.
I'm not sure. NFTs, as they are today, are a hype, but I believe the potential of NFTs is massive.
Yes.
The technology of NFTs, I mean.
Exactly. And I think that everyone realized that regulator catch up innovation. So I think that's my personal opinion. The NFT space, the technology needs to mature a bit more before we're able to classify them and say, you know, is it a financial services? Is it another type of services? You know, how is it used? I mean, under which framework does it go under? And I think this is reflected on under Mika. You know, Mika said, let's put that aside. Let's see how it evolves. We can, you know, commission report, etc. So what we sought to do is let's align. So let's clarify a bit because there's so many questions. You know, so many people say, hey, MFSA, what do you think of NFT and whatever? So we said, let's try to clarify our position to the market. Let's provide clarity, you know, regulatory clarity, because I think this is essential here. So through that guideline, we're clarifying how we want to treat NFT. Essentially, asset classification, as we know, is the most important. So we said, okay, this is how we want to classify NFT under the VFA Act. We took a position that is completely aligned to Mika. So we look at the characteristic. Is it really unique? What are you doing with it? You know, is it a derivative because this is a fractional NFT, etc. So I think that clarity, and then you know where you stand. Am I regulated? If yes, under which framework? Am I unregulated? So we didn't want the period from now to Mika to, you know, see operator, I'm a bit in a gray area or whatever. So again, aligning to Mika, making sure that this is clarified, the asset classification, and always part of the outreach.
And the cool thing, you created also a test for that. Yes. Very similar to the VFA test, which unfortunately is not replicated in Mika, but I believe it
just
would
wait.
Interesting. Because the VFA test, I believe, was one of the biggest inventions of the Maltese regulator, let's call it. Right?
Yes. So,
and you created something similar for NFTs, which I think really, really helps because it gives clarity.
Yes, yes, yes. I think the what we call the FIT, financial instrument test, was a stroke of genius, I must
Definitely.
Say. Asset classification is something that is discussed a lot in preparation to Mika. What the audience needs to understand is that Mika is just the level one. It's just the text. But level two is what we call RTS, Regulatory Technical Standards, which essentially try to harmonize the approach. So on every because we need to realize that we're going to have multiple authorities, obviously, implementing Mika. So how do you do certain things? You know, how do you do authorization, supervision, etc. And all of that is captured by the RTSs. And one of the RTSs is specifically on asset classification, because I think everyone can agree that crypto asset is too wide as a definition.
Well, so we're seeing it happen constantly in the US, where according to SEC,
don't get me started.
But is basically a security, but no one really knows what a security is because they're still relying on the Howey test, which was created by a court judgment many years ago,
and relying on precedent, etc. Yeah, so through all those discussions, because we're very lucky to be part of those either drafting group or working group on those RTS, we have promoted really heavily the FIT, because we believe this is a practical solution to a problem that everyone faces.
As a practitioner who has worked in this industry for the past 5 years, I confirm it, and please try to get the fit or something similar in Mika.
So we're trying to promote it, and we're seeing some appetite. We're seeing some regulator. I mean, obviously, we need to reach a consensus before it's applied. But we're seeing some regulators saying, hey, this could be interesting. I mean, this could be something useful for us and for the market. So I'm really hoping that as they see the benefits of something like the FIT, we could adopt something like that at the European level. But yes, this is something we're promoting. So really, you know, fingers crossed.
I mean, fintech is not just crypto.
Yeah.
So fintech, your team is also, the fintech team is also responsible for payment institutions, electronic money institutions. And Malta was very popular with these institutions some years ago. Then with grey listing and a number of other complications that we had over the years, Malta lost a bit of its appeal. But we, at least from a practitioner point of view, I'm seeing this appeal coming back. The amount of inquiries and also the amount of actual projects in relation to the wider scope of fintech that I'm seeing is quite heartening. And what is your view? Why is Malta again attractive for these payment institutions and particularly electronic money institutions?
All right, there's multiple factors for that. The first one, which might seem not obvious, but since Brexit, if you want to be in an English-speaking country and an operator, either an EMI or a payment institution, your choice is only Malta. So there is that. And we've seen a lot of applicants that had a UK company.
And Ireland, we don't want to forget the Irish.
Yes. But yes, there is this thing of saying, okay, I want to be in Europe. So what are my choices? So that there is that. The second is, who needs EMI and NPI? What type of industry has a banking need that might not be satisfied by the incumbent? And we have two fantastic sectors here, crypto and gaming, that need those banking needs. But not only banking needs, payment need as well, because those two industries are industry that the way they operate are 100% digital. Right, you're not going to a cashier. You're not, you know, handing cash. So you always need to find a way and answer a need from those two industries. That, you know, I want my payment to be processed faster. I want the customer experience to be better. I want to be safer. I want to have this, that. So you have the potential industry here. So I think it's wonderful to come to a jurisdiction and have client there. Client that are either under the same regulator or under a sister authority. So we are all understanding each other. We're all under the same AML authority. So we apply the same standard. You know, there's no differences. So there is that. I think what we can do to get us to the next level is two things. One, from a framework perspective, we're extremely active with Herman, my head, on trying to revamp the rule book, actually creating a rule book for financial institution. We're very active in terms of outreach. There is an association called FIMA locally, and we're very pleased to see that market participants are getting together, consolidating. I like to have one voice of the industry.
Definitely.
We have it with crypto, thanks to the Chamber of Commerce, and I think that's been super beneficial. So we're trying to have an outreach. One, to share expectation. Two, to collect feedback from the participant and saying, is there something that is not clear to you? You know, how can we reach the objective and make sure the market is protected? So that will allow us to have a rule book that is very, very solid, and everyone knows where we stand. Because for the last 10 years, we've been relying on, let's say, the big brother, the credit institution, which is to me fundamentally wrong. Those are two different
animals. Problem is that these institutions still need the credit institutions in most cases in order to be able to for custody purposes mainly. So
do they?
Right now, unfortunately, that, yes.
And this is the second point. What we need to do as a jurisdiction, we're enjoying a very good relationship with CBM, the central bank, mm-hmm. and we're trying to see how we could, from an infrastructure perspective, offer more services to
FI. That would be a game changer. Because right now the biggest problem is that these guys are depending completely
but not only
banks.
So safeguarding, yes, it's a key issue. But instant settlement, having things like right now, an FI wants to settle or make a payment, obviously they have to go through the bank. But we're in a scenario where all the banks are not even in the same instant settlement or instant payment network. So actually the transaction, the pipe work, let's call it, you know, goes to a credit institution that is here in Malta, and to pay another credit institution in Malta, it goes to another central bank and then comes back. How ridiculous is that? There's so much work to do on the infrastructure. And when you look at jurisdictions that have gained popularity in the EMI and FI space, such as Lithuania, for example, the central bank has been central. Central bank had a vision.
Maybe the fact that Herman is the head of the fintech team could help facilitate things with the central bank since he used to work there.
Exactly. So those are the two things.
I would like to add something else. Also, the tech savviness of the fintech team within the MFSA. And I would say also slowly of the entire MFSA. Because I've dealt with other departments recently and I was very pleasantly surprised of their increased tech savviness. I think that is also an advantage. So, for example, we're seeing a lot of projects in embedded finance. We've seen the MFSA come up with a very short sort of...
FinSight,
It's the FinSight, the regular updates you give to the industry.
Correct.
About embedded finance. And to be honest, I have a client who is working in embedded finance and they were, oh my God, a regulator coming up with something on embedded finance. So having this tech savviness will give confidence to operators to feel comfortable to come to an authority. Okay, these guys know exactly what they're doing. They know what we are doing. So that gives me confidence. One last thing about innovation. You have also a sandbox about in technological innovation in financial services. Very briefly, can you give us some information about that?
Yes, so the sandbox essentially has been created to cater for the operator that basically challenged the boundaries of the law, right? So we know there's a catch-up game and we needed that. But most importantly, as a regulator, what I do is risk management. I cannot be effective in risk management if I don't understand the risk. How can I mitigate it? You know? So I think the sandbox also has been created to learn on both sides. And this is why the sandbox is with a testing period. So it's someone that is interested in either being regulated or understand, let's say, the regulatory framework, where they stand or how the product will be, come closer to the MFSA and say, I'd like to submit myself voluntarily to a testing by the regulator. We work on objective, testing objective. We have period in time. It could be 6 months, 1 year, etc.
What was the advantage for the operator?
So the advantage is, one, you start building a relationship with the regulator. And I think in financial services is crucial. Two, at the end of that period, you have clarity. Do I need to be regulated? If yes, under which framework? Because through those 6 months or 1 year, I've looked really into your operation, understand them very well, and I say, that's an investment services, or, oh no, that's a virtual financial
and
assets.
Will I be able to continue operating while I'm applying for the license?
So there is different categories. There is people that never needed a license. Mm-hmm. So this is not, so here you're unregulated, technically. The second category is that you actually a tech provider, so you're not providing a financial services at all, so same thing, you didn't need to be regulated. Or the third category is someone that should be regulated.
Borderline.
Exactly, borderline. And here we have an interplay where we can say, okay, so what if I authorize you and grant you a license, but one of the conditions is that you enter the sandbox, for example, and here you can start operating. Because for me, I've mitigated the risk. So if it was a simple license, maybe I don't feel comfortable because you're doing something, you know, really innovative. But now that I know that I'm going to have a better supervision for 6 months, I'm going to have a better oversight, I feel more comfortable. Mm-hmm. So there's always a way, but it's important. Start the dialogue, you know, because I need to learn, you need to learn. So this is why the sandbox is there. It's an exchange. We learn from each other.
Kamil, one last thing. Why should people come to Malta for AIBC during the Sigma Week, during Malta Week, let's call it that way, in November?
I think not only to AIBC, but I mean, those trade fair, those events are always fantastic opportunity to meet the entire ecosystem, network. You might learn a thing or two. You can maybe meet me. But specifically on this week, what's really interesting is that the MFSA is also holding an event on the 16th of November, especially on crypto and Mika. So I think it would be really interesting for someone that operates in the space to be here for that entire week, because I believe it's an entire week, and take the opportunity to come see us or meet us, you know, outside. So it's for anyone that is curious what Malta can do in fintech, what Malta can do in crypto, be there. Meet the regulator, meet the player, get a bit of see what the landscape looks about, you know, make a connection or two. I think this is really, really, really good. I think this is always good to hear it from the horse's mouth as well, you know, so you can read the regulation or whatever, but speaking with me, you'll understand my approach, and that might, you know, solve some of your issues. So I think this will be the main reason for someone to come.
Kamil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.